It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, the World Health Organization recognized video game addiction as a standalone mental health issue. We'll learn more about the decision and what it might mean for people who are or think they are addicted to video games. First, Wisconsin may be able to get more sales tax money from internet retailers. Governor Scott Walker says that money should be offset by cuts to Wisconsin's income taxes. Last Thursday, the U.S. Supreme Court ruled that states can force online retailers to collect sales taxes. The move overturned a 1992 decision that said states can't require businesses with no physical presence inside their borders to collect those taxes. Under the ruling, Wisconsin could generate as much as $187 million a year. That's according to a study from the U.S. Government Accountability Office. This morning in Madison, Walker said he'd like to see that money go back to the taxpayers.
It shouldn't be a tax increase. It should be just leveling the playing field for retailers and other operations in the state.
Matt DeFore covers state government and politics for the Wisconsin State Journal. Matt, welcome back to Central Time.
Rob, thanks so much for having me back.
Well, you wrote about this, Matt, and it looks like some states across the country have laws that say, okay, if this law changes, boom, we start taxing. Wisconsin's not one of those. What do we have here?
Right. Well, we actually have a law that's addressed this, but it's not clear if it will apply in this case. In the 2013-15 budget, Governor Walker and Republican lawmakers put in place a provision that said any additional sales tax revenue we would generate from a change in federal law would automatically result in the Department of Revenue reducing income tax rates. Now, in this situation, there hasn't been a change in federal law. There's been a U.S. Supreme Court case that's changed the landscape. So it's unclear if that provision would apply. But as you heard in that clip there, Governor Walker's already talking about how we might use that new revenue should he include that in the next state budget.
If Wisconsin, Matt, wants to take advantage of this Supreme Court ruling, what has to happen for us to start collecting these internet sales taxes? Do we need a change in our law, or is this just the Department of Revenue goes to work?
That is still unclear. The Department of Revenue and the Legislative Fiscal Bureau have been researching this issue since the decision, which just came out last week. And so they are still trying to figure out exactly what has to happen next. But it's, you know, we're still trying to find out, too, if this is actually going to happen in the next budget or not. Governor Walker suggested that it might. He signaled that he would do it to put less of a burden on our local brick-and-mortar retailers here. But, you know, that it seems like there's going to be certainly some kind of action. It's just not going to automatically kick in.
Now, if it waits for the next budget, like that's a time frame. That's a ways off, right?
Right, and that provision in the 13-15 budget was based on it wouldn't kick in until after a year, and that's because it would essentially have looked at a year's worth of sales tax receipts. Now, according to the GAO report, you know that it could generate anywhere from $123 to $187 million a year, but there are other factors that could reduce that amount. You know, for example, if they put a some kind of threshold for the number of transactions an online retailer would have in the state before it was affected by the sales tax. You know, in South Dakota, where the Supreme Court case was, it was 200 transactions. So that could reduce that amount. But you know, it's somewhere in that range that we could see in additional revenue.
I guess taking a step back, this is a two-part process. Part one is, do we start collecting this money from internet sales taxes that we're not currently getting? Step two is, what do we do with that? Governor Walker saying income tax. Other people are saying something else. But there's kind of two issues to sort out here, right?
Yeah, and that's as you mentioned earlier, a lot of other states have already decided they're going to go forward with collecting these sales tax. It's potentially a windfall for states that are strapped for cash in areas like education or transportation funding. But you know, again, in the Republicans here, they also took some preliminary action in anticipation of this. It's just it didn't come down the way that perhaps that they thought it was going to come down.
Talking to Matt DeFore from the Wisconsin State Journal about the U.S. Supreme Court ruling on internet sales tax and what that is going to mean for Wisconsin. Matt, in a piece you co-wrote, you talked to state lawmakers. I think for both parties, what kind of things were you hearing?
It's pretty clear to me that the Republicans want to use this to reduce taxes, and that's been consistent with their approach for years now. They've wanted to limit any kind of increased revenue for the state. Of course, with the economy improving, we've seen revenues to the state increase through the sales tax. But yeah, the Republicans are generally, they're looking to offset any additional amount with some kind of cut to the income tax rate. Governor Walker, though, today, you know, suggests a couple other things. For example, this year we saw this $100 per child tax credit. He mentioned today the possibility of expanding that. And he also talked about the maybe something for seniors who don't benefit from that. Of course, it's an election year, so maybe it's not surprising he mentions that kind of stuff. But we also talked to Democratic candidates running for governor. Tony Evers, the state superintendent, certainly mentioned education and transportation as things that need additional funding. Mayor Paul Soglin, I think, mentioned broadband internet, using the money to expand that. We also heard from, I think Matt Flynn talked about reducing property taxes. So that's kind of a tax that's, you know, in line with sort of Republicans are saying. And I think Malin Mitchell also mentioned the idea of using it for some kind of business startup fund or some kind of fund to help businesses that might be negatively affected by online commerce.
Is there a chance that the state legislature would try to do something before the next budget process, not put it off that long?
I would say that's entirely unlikely because today we heard from the Senate Majority Leader, Scott Fitzgerald. He said that they would expect to be done as big tax decisions are usually done in the budget process. And there's really no rush with the legislature out for this season, but he said that they would not likely come back in for a special session to address this.
Now, digging into the internet sales tax a little more, it's not a, you know, there is no internet sales tax happening. What has been the state of the art here in Wisconsin when it comes to when we can or try to collect sales tax on internet purchases?
Yeah, I hear you chuckle because this is kind of a funny thing where the state has had a use tax where they basically ask people when they file their income taxes in the in the winter to indicate how much they had in e-commerce or how many online purchases they made and then pay tax on that. And I think we've had somewhere around 3% of tax filers actually say they've bought anything online.
That's all the people who are buying stuff online, right? About 3%?
3%, I think. And they've collected about $5 million from that. At least this is a study that was done in 2012. So I don't know how reliable that is or how accurate that is, but I think we're expecting the number to be much higher once they actually can tax these online retailers.
And we were already able to tax if we wanted, right, an outfit if they had a physical presence in the state, like prior to
right.
The Supreme Court ruling?
Yes, if you're an online retailer in Wisconsin, you were supposed to be charging a sales tax to Wisconsin consumers. But obviously, if you were selling to somebody in Illinois, Illinois had, you know, wouldn't be charging you a sales tax. So, right.
So what is next? People are talking about it now, but is there really nothing going to happen until the next budget process?
I think that's likely. I mean, the governor seemed to indicate that, too. I mean, again, we have an election here. You've got a bunch of Democrats vying to compete against Scott Walker. And so, you know, it's interesting to pay attention to what these different ideas are and maybe think about how they represent these really stark contrasts in the visions these two parties have for how to govern the state.
And do you see this as being, Matt, a political issue running through November? Or is this just kind of we're going to flare up on it now and then set it aside and find something else to argue about?
I don't really know for sure. My guess is it's a flare-up, but again, I think it speaks to broader differences and priorities for the two parties, and so I think people can look at this as one of many issues where they'll have a clear choice.
And as we wrap up, can you put this $187 million, that's kind of the high-end, people are saying, in income per year, how does that stack up in the scope of our overall state budget?
It's not, you know, a huge amount. It's a, you know, obviously we have this annually $30-some billion budget. All funds, but yeah, it's enough. If for example, it's about as much as we recently got a federal grant to help finish the I-94 project on the southeastern part of the state. It also is the exact same amount as the one-year cost of the child tax credit and the sales tax holiday that's coming up later this year. So those are some examples of what it's the same as.
All right, we'll leave it there. Matt, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thanks very much for having me again. Yep.
That's Matt DeForest, state government reporter with the Wisconsin State Journal. We talked with him about new tax revenue possibilities for Wisconsin following last week's U.S. Supreme Court ruling that said states can tax internet sales. You can weigh in on this issue, by the way. Tweet us at Central Time WPR or email ideas@WPR.org. Should the state take advantage of this opportunity to tax more internet sales in the state? And if so, what should the state do with the $150 million a year, plus or minus? Should it go toward tax relief or roads or schools, as various political parties are saying? Again, you can email ideas at WPR.org or tweet us at Central Time WPR. Right now, the World Health Organization recognized addictive video game playing as a standalone mental health condition. The agency says that people with gaming addiction frequently and compulsively choose games over social interactions, and that in turn can hurt them at school and work. Jeff Ryland is a child and family therapist with Gunderson Health based in La Crosse. He spoke with Central Time producer Jay Carlisle Larson.
Jeff, welcome to Central Time.
It's great to be here.
So looking at what the World Health Organization decided to do, how would you characterize compulsive gaming?
Well, I think the World Health Organization is calling this video gaming addiction. And compulsive gaming is really characterized by someone, and it could be a child, teenager, or an adult, but it's their inability to essentially manage their behavior around a video game or video gaming in general. And so it can get in the way. The gaming behavior itself takes control or takes precedence over other activities that they might otherwise do. They stop maybe going to school or stop going to work or don't get to work as regularly. Maybe they stop socializing in other areas. They start to have impaired control. They might try to stop. They might try to cut back, but they have difficulty doing that. And then lastly, and I think it folds into the first point, is that they start experiencing significant distress or impairment. It gets in the way of relationships. It gets in the way of their health. It gets in the way of their occupation or their academics. It might get in the way of their sleep. So when it starts to cause problems, it is a problem.
So for all of those reasons, video gaming or video game addiction, as we're talking about it right now, might not be at the forefront of what a lot of people think about with addiction. So why would the World Health Organization want to look at this specifically?
You know, that is an excellent question, and I pondered that because I wonder, why are we just targeting video gaming? Why not, let's say, cell phone use or other forms of digital media or technology? And I think that it's probably the one particular subset of technology that probably has the most research behind it in terms of seeing firsthand that it causes problems worldwide. It's not just a problem in this country, it's a problem in other countries. And in fact, in some Asian countries, they've had treatment programs for people who have this addiction for some time now. And so it's not new around the world. It is a little interesting that we're thinking about this alone versus other problematic behaviors like cell phone use as an example. And it's a little bit like saying, you know, beer has alcohol in it, but wine doesn't. You know, I think that it's a matter of time before we maybe broaden this lens even more. But I think even stepping back further, I love that we're having a discussion about the fact that a behavior is now being classified as an addiction, because it really challenges us, I think, as a culture to look at what is an addiction. And even if we take a look at maybe the more current opioid crisis, we're really paying more attention to that, possibly because it is happening to rural America. It's happening to a largely Caucasian population. We used to think about addiction as something that was happening to those people in that zip code, and it really wasn't our problem, and we had a moral spin on it. And we have struggled, I think, as a society to see addiction as a disease and as something that it affects all of us in many different ways. And so it's kind of, to me, it's exciting that we're really talking about this by looking at it through a different lens and saying, maybe there's more to it.
Now, the World Health Organization classified this as a standalone mental health issue, going back to kind of what you were saying about looking at cell phone usage, looking at other technology usage. Does making it a standalone mental health issue do anything specific for clinicians or for people studying addiction across the globe?
Well, I think, and I don't know all of the reasoning for why the World Health Organization selected this particular one, outside of the fact that there's a fair amount of research behind it. I am excited about it because this does happen to affect a younger population, and that if we can at least alert clinicians to the possibility that the population that they're seeing, children or adolescents, may also be struggling with this addictive behavior, I think it can help us to do earlier intervention and treatment. Because really, when we talk about an addiction, and this is, I think, hard for many people to get their heads wrapped around, it's not the substance, it's not the behavior, it's the impact on the brain. And what happens when people engage in any addictive behavior or ingest any addictive substance is it alters our brain. And for younger people, it can change the way their brain develops over time. And so somebody could be using a substance or engaging in an addictive behavior at age 40, it won't have near the impact as that a person who is maybe 30 years younger at age 10 engaging in that same behavior, but because their brain is still developing, it has a far more destructive impact.
We're talking to Jeff Ryland right now. He's a child and family therapist with Gunderson Health System, and we're talking about the World Health Organization's decision to add video game addiction to its international classification of diseases. So, Jeff, there have been some medical professionals who disagree with this decision. Some have argued that there really isn't enough science to back this up, and others have argued that video game addiction isn't a standalone issue, but that it's a symptom of another underlying mental health issue, such as depression. So do you think that they have a point here?
Well, as I said, I think that it's broadening the discussion. It's allowing for a really good debate about this topic. I think that it will allow for individuals to get help more readily because it is being considered as an illness. I won't argue that it's possible that depression and anxiety can also occur, but I would wonder if they are causing or they are the cause of the addictive behavior. I think it's just as likely that the addictive behavior or the underlying problems that maybe led to the addictive behavior could also be a causal factor contributing to the anxiety or depression that people experience. I mean, I think when we go back and look at why do people even develop addictions, for many people, it is because they are trying to escape their moment, the present experience. They're trying to numb their pain. They're trying to deal with boredom, trying to get away from something that's uncomfortable for them. And that behavior or that substance, it becomes a coping mechanism that in itself or eventually becomes maladaptive. So we might have a drink to relax and de-stress. We might do some other thing that helps us to chill out or to escape for a short time. And over time, if it's repeated and it becomes habitual and it is a destructive behavior, it can lead to that addictive process. So I'm not convinced that these behaviors are a symptom of anxiety or depression. I think they can coexist with anxiety and depression.
Now, with any conversation about mental health, the issue of stigma does come up. Could we see a bigger stigma attached to this where people might not seek help in this instance?
Well, I think that it's going to be a challenge for people to seek help, just like it is for any addiction, because we do tend to have some stigmas associated with mental health in general and with addictions in particular, that as a society, we do tend to put a moral spin on this. We do tend to see these people as morally weak or bad or something. I'm hoping that this helps us again to see individuals in society who struggle or suffer with these illnesses as humans who need help just like anyone else. I think we have a ways to go in trying to educate. I certainly would say when I started my career here 32 years ago, there was a lot more stigma around addictive behaviors than there is today. People are far more comfortable talking about the fact that someone in their family struggles with an addiction or struggles with a mental illness than they were three decades ago. But I think we have a way to go yet. And one of the ways that we can kind of keep breaking those barriers down is to have these conversations and to see that there are behaviors beyond substances that can be addictive and that they can happen to anyone. And so I think it's a good thing, but I get why people would maybe have a hard time owning it. And I think the reason is it's kind of counterintuitive, but if you were to have chest pain, or if you were to have a knee that really hurt and you wanted to get it checked out, you would go to your doctor. But the part of your body that would make that decision is your brain. And when somebody has an addiction, the organ that is most impaired is their brain. And so the brain has to make the decision to get help, when it doesn't want to recognize that because the brain is pretty well defended, if that makes sense.
Yeah, and I think the question now that I have for you is, as someone who is both an expert in addiction, but also who does, you know, you have a clinic, what have you, you don't have to go into any personal or confidential details, but what have you seen in your practice?
I think that many clinicians have seen an increase in especially our teenage population and our middle school age population of children who are spending more and more time engaged in video game behaviors. It's cutting into their sleep. It's cutting into their social activities. They've lost interest in other things. Even the thing that I think many parents dread, the beginning of summer when kids start to say, I'm bored, I'm bored, I'm bored. And the go-to for many kids is a video game. You know, that's the one thing that they're not bored about. I think it's a slippery slope. And I'm not saying that all kids who want to play a video game over running around outside have an addiction. I think parents just need to be more mindful of the addictive potential that video gaming can have. I think it's pretty common for parents to say, you know, when they're on their device, I don't have to worry about them. I know where they are. I know what they're doing. They're not bothering me. They're fine. I can get my cleaning done, or I can be on my device. And so there's a little bit of a collusion that goes on in families. So I think that that's not uncommon. But I think certainly we've seen more of this in the last 10 years than we have ever seen before, partly because the technology is so much more prevalent.
Well, Jeff, we'll have to leave it there for right now. But thank you so much for joining us on Central Time.
You are welcome. It's been a pleasure.
That was Jeff Ryland. He's a child and family therapist with Gunderson Health based in La Crosse. He spoke with Central Time producer J. Carlisle Larson about the World Health Organization's decision to recognize video game addiction as a standalone mental health issue. Now, the United States has withdrawn from the United Nations Human Rights Council. Secretary of State Mike Pompeo and U.S. Ambassador to the UN Nikki Haley announced the decision last week.
For too long, the Human Rights Council has been a protector of human rights abusers and a cesspool of political bias. Regrettably, it is now clear that our call for reform was not heeded.
Pompeo and Haley cited anti-Israeli bias on the council and said that many nations on the council had serious human rights problems of their own. Our next guest is here to talk about the role the council plays, what it means that the U.S. has decided to leave the group, and what signal it sends to the international community. Michael Schroeder is senior professorial lecturer and assistant dean in American University's School of International Service. Mike, welcome to Central Time.
Thanks so much for having me today.
Well, the Trump administration's been threatening to leave this Human Rights Council for about a year. What was your reaction when they actually did it?
You know, I don't know if I had a particularly strong reaction in the sense that, like I said, they had sort of said last year that they were, I think, reviewing it and then sort of made a strong threat using often the same kind of language and criticisms of the council that they did when they did. I guess I'm not surprised but I'm also at the same time, I don't think I knew it was coming or anything like that. I think this administration sort of held its cards close, at least to the sense, although they were certainly made very clear their concerns about the council, and even before this decision had made clear that they were not happy with how their reform agenda sort of was unfolding, or the pace at which it was unfolding in the UN General Assembly, which is kind of the overseeing body where a lot of these changes that they wanted to see would ultimately have to be approved.
Before we dig into the reasons why the U.S. left the organization, big picture, are we better or worse off as not being part of this council?
You know, I think it's sort of my own view is that I think we're probably overall worse off in terms of the United States being able to influence both the sort of long-term changes in the structure, the membership, which is one of the big concerns, what's on the agenda, and in particular the kinds of resolutions the United States has been really concerned about, especially resolutions singling out Israel and its human rights practices. In terms of the council itself, I think that remains to be seen. You know, certainly the council has worked without the United States before. Its first years of existence up until President Obama decided to join the council, it operated without the United States, and it was still sort of passing resolutions. It continued to have some of the larger Western democracies as part of it. It was still, to a lesser extent, holding, you know, investigations into sort of the worst human rights abuses. So it's hard to say whether overall the council, for example, lose credibility with sort of the broader international audiences or governments But that would just sort of be my sort of initial reaction, and I think we're just going to kind of have to wait and see.
Ambassador Haley spoke about the goals the U.S. had over the last year with the Human Rights Council. She said the U.S. acted in good faith, but that reforms weren't happening. Here's a little more of what she had to say.
One of our central goals was to prevent the world's worst human rights abusers from gaining Human Rights Council membership. What happened? In the past year, the Democratic Republic of Congo was elected as a member. The DRC is widely known to have one of the worst human rights records in the world. Even as it was being elected to membership in the Human Rights Council, mass graves continued to be discovered in the Congo. Another of our goals was to stop the Council from protecting the world's worst human rights abusers. What happened? The Council would not even have a meeting on the human rights conditions in Venezuela. Why? Because Venezuela is a member of the Human Rights Council.
Mike, can you talk about that issue, human rights abusers, notorious ones in some cases, sitting on this Human Rights Council?
Yeah, so I mean, I think this is sort of a perennial issue, and this goes back even into the negotiations on the creation of the Council as sort of a successor to the Human Rights Commission, which really was truly widely discredited, and most, especially Western democracies, kind of insisted that this thing change. I think it's worth noting at this point in time that this complaint of the United States and the Trump administration, and is also one that's shared by other Western states, and also largely shared by every other administration in the United States, U.S. administration, going back to the Council's creation. So really the only difference here is what the administration did about it, which is to actually withdraw rather than to seek to sort of influence change from inside the Council as a member of that Council. I think it's certainly the way... the fact that the Democratic Republic of Congo was elected, I mean, most of these elections take place at the regional level. And so if the other governments in that region decide that this is who they're going to put up, then unless you get deep changes to the actual membership criteria, meaning like that there's some sort of threshold that we would set to say you have to have this rating as a government in order to participate or to join, there's really no sort of structural way that you can force regions to pick one country over another. I think what the U.S. historically and today have tried to do is get an agreement that there has to be some minimal threshold to be elected to the Council to potentially even be able to run. It's hard to imagine in practice that you could get agreement on what that system would look like or who would get to decide what that threshold is. But I think that that's certainly a longstanding complaint, as the current system has allowed pretty serious human rights abusers with pretty weak human rights practices to be able to sit on the Council. Really, again, the difference comes down to what to do about it and how you can get that accomplished.
Talking to Michael Schroeder from American University's School of International Service, talking about the U.S. withdrawal from the U.N. Human Rights Council. We heard from Rick on Facebook. Rick says the U.S. is a world leader in protecting human rights and helping those in need. He says we don't have to be part of a paper lion like the U.N. to fulfill our role in the world. So, Mike, can we do a lot in the United States if we want to protect human rights without being part of this controversial organization?
Yes, it's a good question, right? I mean, and it comes down to what you assume that the purpose of this, like, UN Human Rights Council is. I think if you assume that its primary function was created was to be the global enforcer, the global protector of human rights, and really sort of be an independent legal investigatory body that could then actually impose penalties on countries who fell short, I think you're going to be deeply disappointed. And I'm not sure the United States wants that. I think it's certainly not clear that the United States, any U.S. administration, wants a council that is free of political influence. They want to be able to protect and their friends and allies, much as other great powers seek to protect their friends and allies. But I think the better way to think about what the Human Rights Council does is to sort of think about it in the broader sort of international human rights architecture, and that includes sort of domestic bilateral relations we have, where we sort of tie, in particular sometimes military and other assistance, to countries' human rights records, and we can certainly continue to use that lever. Regional organizations in both in the Americas, but also, you know, working with our partners elsewhere to help them build up capacity. So it's only one piece of it all, and I think the United States can still work through bilateral and other regional and organizations. That being said, I do think that there is a risk that the Human Rights Council itself, doesn't get to enjoy some of the benefits that would come with the United States being actively engaged in it, and therefore it would weaken one piece of that overall architecture. So I do think that to that extent, if your long-term goal is to strengthen human rights around the world, I think that it's probably going to be hurt a little bit. You know, at this point in time, the Trump administration, you know, it's sort of where human rights fits into its larger foreign policy strategy. I've sort of heard Ambassador Haley's comments, but when you think sort of more broadly about sort of what the president has said in terms of what he sees as priorities in places like North Korea and dealing with the ISIS threat in Syria, human rights hasn't always risen to the top, at least on a lot of the sort of issues that get the spotlight. So I think that will be at least as important to the United States' ability to continue to use even its bilateral leverage, since it's withdrawing from this kind of multilateral forum.
Do we have a thing like you were describing, the Human Rights Council not being an independent arbiter that generally everybody agrees, yeah, these are the ones you look to investigate claims of human rights abuses and maybe to have some kind of sanctions?
So I think we should, you know, I think at the resolution, the political body itself, I think, is very much a political body, right? The membership where the government sit and pass resolutions. That being said, the council, a couple of the big improvements from the perspective of human rights advocates with the creation of the council in 2006 was, number one, that they did strengthen and give a much bigger role to what they would call human rights experts who do the investigations. And these are established almost exclusively human rights lawyers, oftentimes who are very well recognized in the field, who are empowered, given mandates by the council to go in and investigate. In fact, they've investigated to the extent possible with Syria. Often that meant having to sort of work particularly with sort of refugee populations and gain firsthand accounts from them. But North Korea, and that these investigations and even the threat of having them publicly discussed often has led to some, you know, some pretty serious diplomatic pressure. It's not going to turn the tide of war. It's not going to get governments to sort of turn over what they see as fundamental interests. But it has, for example, I think some of the investigations into Syria have sort of led to pressure on Russia to allow humanitarian missions and mandates to go through, even in the Security Council. North Korea, when it was being investigated and the Human Rights Council was threatening to send that report up to the Security Council, in fact, suddenly the doors opened and cooperation with the investigator became significantly better. So that piece of it is sort of a more investigatory, sort of expert-driven process. This other big piece, I think, is what we call the Universal Periodic Review. And this is, I think, one of the big concessions that the United States and a lot of other advocates of the newly created Human Rights Council got out of those 06 talks, which was that there would be a process where every few years, every member of the UN system would have to go through a peer review of its human rights practices. Now, I think you'd be naive to think that this is a politics-free review. Nonetheless, when a country is up for review, and again, nobody can escape scrutiny here, every country must periodically go through it, the group of countries that lead the way is expected to pull together reports from experts, to pull together information reports from civil society groups, which is a pretty major step, right? When governments don't tend to prefer to be able to self-report their human rights practices and outcomes, to suddenly civil society getting a say in what these reports say. And while you know, some parts of the deliberations around the findings are public and others are private, this was seen as a major step forward. And even if the outcomes of those reports weren't, again, like a legal adjudication of the evidence, at least the fact that they couldn't escape some sort of periodic review shown a spotlight on those countries' practices, and that often helped mobilize domestic support for human rights activists and help them link up with international activists and so forth. And so that could be used to kind of nudge countries towards slightly better human rights practices. And for countries who actually often were transitioning from sort of more authoritarian regimes and wanted to get better at human rights practices, that became a process for them to actually kind of learn. And it tended to create a mechanism for some sort of peer engagement where you could share technical expertise bilaterally or multilaterally.
Talking to Mike Schroeder from American University's School of International Service. He's with us to talk about the U.S. decision to pull out of the U.N. Human Rights Council. And you can join in at 800-642-1234. What do you think of this decision? What signal do you think this sends to the rest of the world? If you're critical of the UN and this Human Rights Council, tell us why. And if you worry about the U.S. role in promoting human rights around the world, let us know that, too. Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We'll pick up the conversation coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Right now, we continue the conversation about why the United States decided to pull out of the UN Human Rights Council and what it might mean for diplomatic relations in the future. Mike Schroeder stays with us, Assistant Dean at American University's School of International Service. And you could join in at 800-642-1234. Do you agree or disagree with the decision to leave the Human Rights Council? What questions do you have for our guest? Call 800-642-1234 or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We heard from Greg on Facebook. Greg says the move clearly tells brutal leaders around the world that the U.S. doesn't care anymore and they can go ahead. Mike, do you worry that this could be seen as a green light from the United States that we're opting out of human rights enforcement?
So it's a really good question, and I think you see this raised. I think a number of human rights activists in particular become very nervous about this, often when it's seen in the context of other sort of foreign policy decisions where human rights haven't been put at the forefront. You know, I think this is going to make it easier. It's one less vote in the council. So if you want to pass a resolution on Israel, I think it's going to be easier for the council to do that moving forward than it was when the United States, and there's actually evidence to support this, when the United States was part of the council. It significantly dropped both the number of special sessions held on Israel, but also significantly dropped just the number of one-off resolutions. Went down to about 20% of resolutions from what it was, which was an overwhelmingly large number than that. So I think on that front, in terms of will authoritarian leaders think that somehow this means that that human rights are not on the international agenda and that they will pay, that they'll either, their abuses will not either be discovered or potentially face some form of shaming, I think that would probably be a bit strong. I don't think the U.S. role is so definitive inside the council that that'll change the council. I mean, it still has the U.N.'s imprimatur, and so for countries that, you know, want that matters, I think that the council will continue to play a role there.
Let's talk about that Israel issue that was specifically raised by Ambassador Haley and others as a reason to leave. A lot of people I've seen, even people who say, yes, Israel has human rights problems in occupied territories, even people say that, then say, but proportionally, they get way more attention from the Human Rights Council than a lot of other countries with abuses of their own. Is there something to that?
Yeah, I mean, I think this is a longstanding criticism that sort of goes beyond even, you know, again, the United States. Certainly, the Trump administration is by no means new. This is a criticism that came starting with the Bush administration and was one of the reasons they chose not to initially join when they created the council. In fact, it was one of the reasons that the Obama administration decided to join was that they wanted to have that influence. And in fact, again, the CFR, the Council of Foreign Relations, has a report that kind of documents what that influence was, especially in terms of outcomes. It hasn't changed, on the other hand, the fact that Israel retains a single agenda item on that council, a standing agenda item, is tied to Israel. So I think that has certainly been a long-standing issue in the council, that Israel remains literally a standing item for the council, never mind the sort of one-offs. But again, those decreased significantly under the President Obama's sort of time in office, and it's not clear. So that's, I think it remains open whether withdrawing will have a positive impact there or even undercut those resolutions in terms of in the eyes of those who look to them.
Let's go to a caller now. Brian is with us in Fort Atkinson. Brian, hi.
Hi. Yeah, I think this is, it won't help. I'd rather think that we should be part of that or remain in that that would be more of an influence.
Gotcha. Brian, thanks for that call. So better to have a seat at the table, even if it's a flawed organization, Michael.
Yeah, I mean, I think Brian's point is sort of well taken by a lot of sort of activists who either look to the President Obama's era and look to the sort of influence, the nudging forward as they saw it on the agenda. Human Rights Watch has made a sort of very similar statement. I mean, I think the other way to think about Brian's question or sort of comment is whether the United States can actually not just change individual resolutions on, and how much Israel is the focus of those resolutions, but can they actually get the changes, negotiate the changes that they want to the council from the outside? That it's not clear to me, or at least I haven't seen any evidence from the administration yet that would support that view. Withdrawal, I think the one thing withdrawal does is it puts a media spotlight on the immediate practices of the council. And so at least in the short run, it has put a spotlight, including on some of the weaknesses of the council. How that translates into long-term bargaining leverage to get changes that have frankly been very hard to achieve so far, I think remains a bit of a mystery to me.
Ryan, thanks for that call. We'll go next to Matthew in Madison. Matthew, hi.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I was just wondering about the optics and timing of this. I find it ironic just with our current immigration crisis at the border and also Trump's meeting with Kim Jong-un and touting how great a leader he is with all the human rights violations there.
Matthew, thanks for the call. Michael?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's, I have no inside information into how the ultimate decision was taken. I think the optics, though, is a good question. You know, again, the Trump administration has made clear that this was on their plate, you know, last year, and certainly then I took seriously the possibility that they might act on that threat. So I do think it has been part of their longer-term agenda. That being said, it's hard to see in what context it's taken place. You know, it may be around sort of issues that were brought up around, wanting to sort of signal to authoritarian leaders that if they're willing to cut deals on other issues that matter to the United States, as President Trump sees our national interests, that he's willing to give them a pass on human rights. It may be, his sort of resentment at the Human Rights Council last week, sort of having the High Commissioner for Human Rights really sort of pretty bluntly criticize U.S. immigration policy and U.S. Refugee rights protections. And the other context, though, that it might be worth thinking about it is in the sort of president's sort of apparent sort of and rhetorical disdain anyway, if not outright disdain, for multilateral agreements and institutions writ large. So this could just be seen as another indication whether it was pulling out of the Iran deal or pulling out of the Paris agreements. So it's really hard to get a sense of what drives this. But I think that, and I think the optics are going to kind of depend on what context you see this decision being taken.
In our last few moments, Mike, a lot of people have pointed toward a growing trend toward authoritarian governments in many countries around the world. Are you worried that human rights are going to be taking more of a back seat in the years, maybe decade to come?
You know, that's a great question. You know, we definitely have seen around the world, and there's lots of evidence to support this kind of democratic backsliding, both in terms of actual moves to authoritarianism and then sort of some troubling authoritarian attitudes developing even in some more stable democracies. I would say that the period of human rights, I think if you're comparing it to kind of the heyday of the 90s, which is where I grew up, and we sort of thought, you know, with the United States, quote-unquote, winning the Cold War and democracy ascendant, we would see kind of human rights advance, not perfectly and not linearly, but in fits and starts, but, you know, towards an ultimate positive end. I think if we look at the broader sweep in history, I think you can see that we're at a point that's going to be a difficult one for the Human Rights Project. And what we took as assumptions in the 90s and early 2000s, I absolutely don't think we can take as assumptions that human rights will be at the forefront of many countries' priorities.
And we'll leave it there. Thanks to Michael Schroeder from American University's School of International Service, talking about the United States' decision to pull out of the UN Human Rights Council, that decision announced last week. Have you ever gotten a family recipe handed down, maybe written on that note card or a piece of paper, or had someone email it to you, a little more modern? Or have you taken an old family recipe and tried to bring it to life? Well, you're not alone, and you're not the first by a long shot. A new project is trying to recreate recipes that were written down 4,000 years ago. Researchers at Yale and Harvard University have these old clay tablets that ancient Babylonians used to write stuff down on, and one of the things, it turns out, ancient Babylonians wrote down was recipes. They're people just like us, I guess. The researchers teamed up with chefs to figure out how to make the dishes in a codex of recipes that might be the world's oldest known cookbook. So what kind of foods were they making and did they try to recreate? Well, they liked to get a good stew on, including a lamb stew with beets, another lamb stew with milk and grain cakes that they said was better than you'd think, plus herbs in both of those. And there was a veggie stew with beer bread in it. And the Babylonian headline for this recipe, the title was Unwinding, which they think might have been, it was a symbol that meant unwinding a knot. They think it might have been a food that you're supposed to eat when you wanted to relax. So it might be the earliest known evidence of human comfort food. Maybe a Food Friday on Ancient Babylon coming up. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network.